Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, Part 4, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. In the past week, there have been a number of interesting disclosures, ranging from considerable and heated discussion in the media about warnings that elements of U.S. intelligence had and briefings that they had given to the Bush administration about September 11th. And there have also been some perhaps even more disturbing indications that something very big may be in the offing, including perhaps a nuclear attack, some sort of nuclear terrorist incident in the Northeast or someplace else. We're going to be reprising some elements from past broadcasts and supplementing those. And one of the things to note is who actually is behind Al-Qaeda, what it appears to be, frankly, which is an extension of the underground Reich. This is, meaning the quote, war on terrorism, unquote, is, in my opinion, a direct extension of the Second World War. Reprising quickly a Nazi geopolitical concept, and that is the concept of the Earth Island. Look at a globe, look at a map. Look at the landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way on across Europe, the former Soviet Union, most of the Middle East, China, and India. That is one giant landmass. The Nazis called that the Earth Island. If you look across the center of the Earth Island, you will see a mass of Muslim population, and you will see that population overlapping most of the areas where the world's petroleum reserves exist. In the Nazi viewpoint, control the Earth Island, and by controlling the Muslim population of same, you will, and you control the world. In addition, the world's 1.2 billion Muslims are regarded by the Nazis as a very useful and altogether expendable commodity to wipe out not only the United States, but the Jews. And if the United States and the Jews should happen to wipe out the Muslims and the Arabs, so much the better in the Nazi viewpoint. This is both sides against the middle. So note who is helping to fund the horrors that have already taken place and the horrors that are about to take place. We're going to be taking a look at the ties that bind, reprising an article that we looked at in For the Record 359 from the Financial Times of Wednesday, May 8th of 2002, and consider this in connection with the latest warnings. Bin Laden supporters still funding Al-Qaeda, unquote, by Kathy Newman, a political correspondent. The Al-Qaeda terrorist network has been deluged with funds from Osama bin Laden's Saudi supporters, note that, since the start of the Middle East crisis, a British intelligence dossier has revealed. Intelligence chiefs have also warned the government that Mr. bin Laden could be plotting another terrorist atrocity on the scale of the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. One senior minister said he was shocked by the scale of the threat outlined in the chilling intelligence briefing presented to the government recently. It suggested that the September 11th atrocities could be repeated at any time. Ministers are concerned that although the U.S. and the U.K. remain officially on high alert for further terrorist attacks, the public has become complacent about the risk. The minister said, quote, "Bin Laden might be cornered in a cave, but that won't necessarily prevent Al-Qaeda from carrying out further attacks. We were pretty shocked at what we heard." Quote, "The American attacks were 5 years in the planning. Who knows what could also be in the pipeline," unquote. Despite the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, the Al-Qaeda network has been regrouping. There have been a series of arrests and terrorist funds have been targeted around the world, but the network has been kept afloat by new money, note, from Saudi Arabia, and a stream of fresh recruits. Sometimes you can make a long story short. In my discussion of the Underground Reich, the Bormann Organization, connections with the Bush family, the oil business, and Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda, things I was warning about well before the 2000 election, just look at the recent conference that Crown Prince Abdullah had with Crown Prince George Walker bin Talal Abdul Aziz, the colonial magistrate for the Saudi states of America. And look at that picture of George with his arm around Crown Prince Abdullah. That is rather like the appeasement of Hitler at Munich. And we're going to be taking a look at the ties that bind, and one of the things that binds George Bush to the vast majority of Americans, and they are bound with, frankly, guilt and responsibility, and that is oil. And through oil, money. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the flows between Saudi Arabia, between powerful interests around the world, and in particular, we're going to take a look at financial transactions involving the Underground Reich. In addition to the ties that bind, this program might be subtitled Connecting the Dots, and I've forgotten how many of those I've done, but we're going to be illustrating the ties that bind, and we're going to be doing so by connecting the dots. One of the major areas of exploration of these broadcasts for many, many years has been the nexus surrounding the P2 Lodge, or Propaganda Due Lodge, in Italy, that headed up by former Mussolini fascist Licio Gelli, an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. We have in turn taken a look at the profound overlap between the P2 milieu and the Vatican banking scandals. Two members of the P2, Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona, both of whom died under strange circumstances, were advisors to the Vatican Bank. And there was a very, very suspicious series of transactions going through the Vatican Bank that in past discussion we have termed the Mediterranean merry-go-round. Note that the current president of Italy, the current head of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi, was a member of the P2. Note the strong connections between Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia and Silvio Berlusconi, their mutual connections to Youssef Nada, the head of Al-Taqwa. Note that the Gulf Office subsidiary of Al-Taqwa was investigated in connection with Operation Clean Hands, which in turn investigated the P2 and Licio Gelli. I can appreciate that many of the things that I'm talking about will sound strange or incredible. Get the back programs from Spitfire. I'll tell you more about that later. And take advantage of the programs that are on air, and those are available. All of the For the Record programs are available from sister station WFMU. And in particular, take advantage of the small book that I have already put together about September 11th. Those are the program descriptions for the Record 325 and counting. They are up on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. They have been reformatted to make them easier to read and to use, and they already constitute a book about September 11th, relatively short book, maybe 150 pages and counting, but it's a book nonetheless. Now, one of the major financial conduits that we have looked at in connection with the funding of Al-Qaeda, allegedly, and certainly with SECO, the Saudi investment company, the very powerful European branch of the massive bin Laden economic empire, we're going to take a look at In These Times magazine's issue of March 15th of 2002, and we're going to be taking a look at another excerpt of a very important article called Explosive Revelations, this by Lucy Komiser, spelled K-O-M-I-S-A-R, excuse me. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. Now, the Clearstream Network is in turn an offshoot of Sedel, and it was 50% owned by Deutsche Börse, the German stock exchange. That was the Clearstream Network was bought out completely by Deutsche Börse in early 2002, after September 11th. One of the founders of the Clearstream Network is in turn Ernest Baquez, whom, as we have seen, has claimed that Clearstream was heavily involved with Osama bin Laden. He also has alleged that the September 11th financial conduits would ultimately go to a series of financial fronts set up by Nazi banker François Genoux, about whom we will say more later in the program. In These Times, March 15th of 2002, their web address will be annotated in the Spitfire description of For the Record 360. Lucy Komiser writes as follows. And bear in mind that her source here, Ernest Baquez, one of Europe's foremost experts about money laundering, helped to set up the Clearstream Network and then blew the whistle on it later when it became apparent that it was being used for corrupt purposes. Speaking of Clearstream and the Banco Ambrosiano and the Mediterranean merry-go-round, P2, etc., Sedel and its main competitor, Brussels-based Euroclear, were starting to manage transfers of, quote, Eurodollars, unquote, U.S. currency kept in banks outside the United States. According to Barbara Garson's book, Money Makes the World Go Round, Eurodollars were invented in the 1950s by the Chinese and the Soviets so they would not have to put their assets in banks where the U.S. government could seize them. But others saw value in Eurodollars and they began to be traded for other currencies. Some banks attracted Eurodollars with higher interest than was being paid in America, and U.S. corporations and individuals began using the accounts to avoid laws on domestic banks. The Euro money market was born. By the 1990s, the Federal Reserve estimated that about two-thirds of U.S. currency was held abroad as Eurodollars, skipping down. By 1980, Ernest Backes had become Sedel's number three official in charge of relations with clients, but he was fired in May of 1983. Backes says the reason given for his sacking was an argument with an English banker, a friend of the CEO, quote, I think I was fired because I knew too much about the Ambrosiano scandal, Backes says. Banco Ambrosiano was once the second most important private bank in Italy, with the Vatican as a principal shareholder and loan recipient. The bank laundered drug and arms trafficking money for the Italian and American mafias, and in the 1980s channeled Vatican money to the Contras in Nicaragua and Solidarity in Poland. The corrupt managers also siphoned off funds via fictitious banks to personal shell company accounts in Switzerland, the Bahamas, Panama, and other offshore havens. Banco Ambrosiano collapsed in 1982 with a deficit of more than $1 billion. Unknown to many moviegoers, Banco Ambrosiano inspired a subplot of The Godfather, Part 3. Several of those behind the swindle have met untimely ends. Bank Chairman Roberto Calvi was found hanged under Blackfriars Bridge in London. Michele Sindona, convicted in 1980 on 65 counts of fraud in the United States, was extradited to Italy in 1984 and sentenced to life in prison. In 1986, he was found dead in his cell, poisoned by cyanide-laced coffee. Another suspect, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, now lives in Sun City, Arizona, with a Vatican passport. U.S. authorities have ignored a Milan arrest warrant for him. Just 2 months after Backes' dismissal in 1983, Soissons, 48, and healthy, was found dead in Corsica where he'd gone on vacation. Top Sedel officials had the body returned immediately and buried with no autopsy, announcing that he had died of a heart attack. His family now suspects he was murdered. If Soissons was murdered, it was also related to what he knew about Ambrosiano, Backes says. When Soissons died, the Ambrosiano affair wasn't yet known as a scandal. After it was revealed, I realized that Soissons and I had been at the crossroads. We moved all those transactions known later in the scandal to Lima and other branches. Nobody even knew there was a Banco Ambrosiano branch in Lima and other South American countries. After Sedel, Backes got a job in the Luxembourg stock market and later became a manager of a butcher's cooperative. But he kept friends inside the clearinghouse and began to collect information and records about Sedel's operations. With Soissons out of the way, there was nothing to stop the abuse of the system. Whereas Soissons had refused numerous requests to open non-published accounts from institutions such as Chase Manhattan in New York, Chemical Bank of London, and numerous subsidiaries of Citibank, Sedel opened hundreds of non-published accounts in total irregularity, especially after the arrival of CEO André Lucy in 1990. No longer were they just sub-accounts of officially listed accounts, Backes charges. Some were for banks that weren't subsidiaries or even official members of Sedel. At the start of 1995, Sedel had more than 2,200 published accounts, but in reality, according to documents obtained by Bacchus, Sedel that year managed more than 4,200 accounts for more than 2,000 clients from 73 countries. And more about the background of Sedel and Clearstream. Clearstream, and again, a major funding conduit according to Bacchus for September 11th, Clearstream also strongly connected to SECO, the Saudi investment company, European branch of the powerful bin Laden economic and financial empire. Clearstream was formed in 1999 out of the merger of Sedel and the compensation company of Deutsche Börse, the German stock exchange. No accounts are secret, insists spokesman Graham Cope. We are controlled by the local authorities who have access to information on all accounts. The term secret is misused again and again. Our customers choose to have unpublished accounts, which simply means, like a telephone number, they choose not to display the name and number in our publications. Customers often have unpublished accounts, which they use for their own internal management purposes to ensure there is no confusion between their accounts, unquote. But Bacchus thinks otherwise. I discovered an increasing number of unpublished accounts, he says. There were more unpublished than published accounts, and a large proportion were not sub-accounts of a principal account, which is what the system was supposedly for. The owners of these accounts were not inscribed on the official clients of the firm, unquote. And, by the way, the Soissons alluded to there was Gerhard Soissons, along with Bach as one of the founders of the Clearstream Network. Now, again, by taking a look at some of the ties that bind, and by the way, for details about the death of Roberto Calvi, who was found hanged under Blackfriars Bridge in London, for details about the death of Michele Sindona, RFA programs 17 through 21, dealing with the events in and around the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 81, and the death of his predecessor a couple of years earlier, that is all discussed at considerable length in RFA's 17 through 21. Those are available from Spitfire. Still more about that affair, and this from a website bulletin, deepblacklies.co.uk. This is by a fellow named David Guyatt. It's called Revelations. It is a part of a review of a book called Revelations by Ernest Bacchus and Denise Robert. Some years following the opening of the first two accounts, Roberto Calvi was later found hanged beneath London's Blackfriar Bridge. And that, again, alludes to Roberto Calvi. I would note that Mr. Guyatt had considerable experience with Clearstream. He had met Gerhard Soissons along with Ernest Bacchus while working for the Wall Street investment firm Blythe Eastman Dillon. Now, more about the Clearstream Network, and we're going to take a look at allegations also by Lucy Komeiser in a sidebar to the In These Times article I just read. And this deals with the alleged role of the Clearstream Network in the October Surprise, as it has come to be known, the deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages who had been taken prisoner until after Jimmy Carter's election defeat, or his humiliation and consequent election defeat, were assured. Bear in mind in this connection the allegation that was carried in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle of March 12th of 2002 that it was Nazi banker François Janoux who paid for the Ayatollah Khomeini's exile in France. Bear in mind also that François Janoux was heavily involved with the Arab financial branches in Algeria. That was much of his start. That constituted much of his start as a banker with various Middle Eastern nationalist movements. And note where some of these October Surprise monies came from. This is from October Surprises, a sidebar to the In These Times article from March 15th, also by Lucy Komeiser. It reads, in November of 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Iran was seized and 52 Americans were held hostage. Their capture and the Carter administration's failure to win their release became a major issue in the 1980 presidential campaign. Carter had frozen billions in Iranian assets in U.S. banks, money that was being claimed by American firms and individuals who had lost property in the Islamic Revolution. American and Iranian officials were negotiating the amount of funds to be released in return for freeing the hostages. The Iranians also wanted Carter to release arms that had been ordered and paid for by the deposed Shah. Reagan campaign officials allegedly met with Iranian representatives several times during the 1980 campaign, promising arms and money if Iran delayed release of the hostages until after the November election. This scandal would become known as the October Surprise, unquote. Reagan won the election, but Carter officials continued to negotiate with the Iranians. Finally, around the turn of the year, an accord was reached under which the United States would release $4 billion but no arms. However, the Iranians did not release the hostages immediately. A few days before Reagan's inauguration, Ernest Baca recalls, Saddell got an urgent joint instruction from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England to transfer $7 million in bearer bonds, $5 million from an account of Chase Manhattan Bank, and $2 million from an account of Citibank, both in offshore secrecy havens. The money was to go to the National Bank of Algeria and from there to an Iranian bank in Tehran. Baquez was informed that the $7 million was a small fraction of sums being sent from around the world and concentrated in the Algerian bank. He was told the transfers were linked to the fate of the hostages. The Fed and the Bank of England were not members of Saddell and by its rules had no right to order the transfers. Baquez's two superiors were absent. He informed the president of the Saddell Administrative Council, Edmund Israel, then acted to execute the order. Israel, now honorary chairman, did not respond to phone and email messages. On January 20, 1981, about 15 minutes after Reagan took the oath of office, the hostages were finally freed. Reagan and then Vice President George Bush have always denied the payoff. And this, again, dealing with the October Surprise. We're going to review an element that we looked at in, for the record, program number 354. And this concerns Salem bin Laden, who in turn was represented by James R. Bath, and who was very closely connected through James R. Bath to George W. Bush. He also may have been involved with some of the October Surprise negotiations. Reviewing now from the book, In the Name of Osama bin Laden, subtitled Global Terrorism and the Bin Laden Brotherhood, published by Ronan Jacquard, published in softcover by the Duke University Press, this from the paperback edition ISBN number 0-8223-2991-3. Of Salem bin Laden and his alleged involvement in the October Surprise, Bin Laden's son, Salem bin Laden, was also very close to the Saudi king, and it is likely that he rendered significant services to the monarchy, in particular by carrying out secret missions. According to several witnesses, his mysterious death is evidence of this. In 1988, a BAC-111 plane piloted by Salem crashed in Texas. His death gave rise to speculations about the exact role he played for King Fahd and the Saudi government in secret operations in the Middle East and Central America. For instance, there was an indication from American sources that he was connected to a secret meeting between Iranian and American emissaries in Paris in October of 1980. Some felt that his death was not an accident. By the way, he may also have been killed in the crash of a light plane, not a BAC-111. But his death is very interesting in light of the connections. Now, as a branch to a next major element of discussion, we're going to be talking about SECO, the Saudi investment company, which apparently had a number of different Clearstream accounts, according to Ernest Baca. Bear in mind that the co-chairman of the board of SECO is a Swiss citizen named Baudin Dunant, who in turn was a lawyer for François Genoux, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the September 11th investigation in a number of different contexts, ranging from Genoux's connections to Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker's French attorney, who is Isabelle Coutant-Père, the future wife of Carlos the Jackal. Genoux was alleged in the March 12th Chronicle article to have been the founder of Altaqua. Ernest Backes has alleged that the financial conduits for September 11th, now apparently being replumbed from Saudi sources in anticipation of another attack on the United States. Ernest Backes has claimed that François Genoux was heavily involved with the setting up of those financial institutions. Turning once again to the book In the Name of Osama Bin Laden of Geneva SICO, the Saudi investment company, it is headed by Islam Bin Laden, and the board of directors is made up almost exclusively of members of the family clan, except for a Swiss citizen, Baudin Dunant. This well-known lawyer from French-speaking Switzerland, who was on the boards of several dozen companies, came to public notice in 1983 when he agreed to represent the Swiss banker François Genoux, a controversial figure who had been a disciple of Hitler and sole heir of Goebbels' copyrights before becoming one of the financiers of the FLN during the Algerian War. The friendships of the Bin Ladens seem sometimes surprising, but they are logical. François Genoux has always been pro-Arab. Now, continuing with the ties that bind, for the record, program number 360, to the ties that bind, part 4, François Genoux, Nazi banker, Odessa leader, primary operative on behalf of the Underground Reich, utilizing in a most cynical fashion the Arabs and other Muslim members of the population of what the Nazis called the Earth Island, the huge landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way on up through Europe, through most of the former Soviet Union, embracing most of the Middle East, China, and India. The Muslim population of that landmass, which also controls most of the world's oil reserves, have long been targeted by the Nazis as allies and proxy warriors. They, too, are considered lower evolutionary life forms, but they're considered useful, particularly when it comes to killing the British, American, and Jews. François Genoux, a primary Nazi banker, had befriended many of the Arabo-fascists and Islamo-fascists, including Haj Amin al-Husseini, himself a major in the SS, the recruiter of Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, as I've spoken about in the past, and the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. To give you an idea of how far back some of these ties that bind go, we're going to reprise an article that we excerpted in For the Record Program 359. This article was originally published in the Philadelphia Inquirer of January 5th of 1997. It is by David Lee Preston, titled Hitler's Swiss Connection, and it's about François Genoux. And these ties have been binding for a long time. As a teenager in the fall of 1932, François Genoux briefly met the man who was to shape the rest of his life. In a hotel in Bad Godesberg, near Bonn, the young Genoux encountered Adolf Hitler, skipping down. In 1934, back in Switzerland, the 19-year-old Genoux joined the pro-Nazi National Front, and 2 years later, he began to forge the other political links that would prove so valuable. He traveled to Palestine, and there he met the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the pro-Nazi religious and political leader of Palestinian Muslims, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was to spend most of World War II in Germany, and who, according to British author Gita Sereny, quote, would consider Genoux a confidant until his death in 1974. Genoux traveled to Berlin frequently during the war to see his friend, the Grand Mufti, unquote, and visited him afterward many times in Beirut, according to Le Monde correspondent Jean-Claude Buret. The Grand Mufti, quote, entrusted Genoux with the management of his enormous financial affairs, unquote, according to Sereny. And bear in mind the numerous allegations of links between Altaqua, Genoux, the Clearstream Network, and September 11th, those discussed in past broadcasts. Now, considering also François Genoux's connections with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in turn connected to Carlos the Jackal, the law firm of Jacques Vergès, one of whose members, Isabel Couton-Père, is the French attorney for 20th hijacker Zacharias Moussaoui, as we've looked at in past programs. In For the Record program number 350, an excerpt of which we're about to reprise, we took a look at a statement by Sheikh Rahman in which he said, quote, "The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years," unquote. I've dealt with that in For the Record program number 339, I believe, 338, and also in number 349 and 350. I've speculated that the Kennedy referred to was Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was Saran Saran, a Palestinian Arab, and evidentiary tributaries there running in the direction of the underground Reich and related elements of U.S. intelligence, as we've discussed in the past. Now, in For the Record program 350, we talked about the evidentiary tributaries linking the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, its head George Habash and Wadi Haddad, and George's brother Fuad Habash with the assassination of Robert Kennedy. One of the PFLP hijackings that we took a look at in past discussions of Genoux was the hijacking of a Lufthansa plane on February 21st, 1972. There was an interesting passenger, considering the one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, turning again to the David Lee Preston article. More is to be learned about Genoux's contact with the Americans. The State Department has yet to declassify 16 documents relating to Genoux. 29 other documents relating to his application for a visa or permit to enter the U.S. remain classified. The Lufthansa Boeing 747 bound for Frankfurt was ready to take off in Bombay when the control tower received a bizarre message. Quote, "Call us the Victorious Jihad. If you call us Lufthansa, we won't answer you," unquote. It was the evening of February 21, 1972, and Palestinian hijackers had taken the plane hostage. Among the 188 passengers was Joseph Kennedy, 19-year-old son of assassinated Senator Robert F. Kennedy. The next day, a letter from Cologne demanded $5 million for the Organization for the Victims of the Zionist Occupation, unquote. In perfect English, the letter gave Lufthansa explicit instructions. A man carrying a suitcase with the money should wear a black jacket and gray pants, disembark at the Beirut airport holding Newsweek magazine in his left hand and the suitcase in his right hand, and go back to the parking lot. With the key in the envelope from Cologne, he was to open an old Volkswagen parked under a sycamore tree and read the instructions on the rear seat. The jet flew to Yemen, where the crew and passengers were freed, including the young Kennedy, and $5 million in used bills went to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which has committed numerous international terrorist attacks since. The operation was orchestrated by the Palestinian terrorist Wadi Haddad with the assistance of François Genoux, who drove overnight to Cologne with his wife, carrying the letter with the ransom demand. After sending the letter to Lufthansa and to news agencies, Genoux and Elisabeth took off for vacation in the Belgian Ardennes. Quote, "The amount of money demanded of Lufthansa was very high," Genoux told French journalist Pierre Payen, revealing his role in the hijacking in a biography published this year in Paris. Quote, "Too low a number would have made us lose credibility. Too high a number might have made the operation fall through, especially considering how quickly the money had to be collected," unquote. Again, noting the PFLP Genoux connection there, remember that Baudin Dunant, co-chairman of the board of SICO, the European branch of the Bin Laden business interest, business empire, was an attorney who represented Genoux. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt of For the Record program number 350, The One Who Killed Kennedy Was Trained for 3 Years, and bearing in mind just how far back some of these ties that bind go, bearing in mind that Joseph Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's son, was a passenger on this plane that was hijacked, let's listen to some of the other evidentiary tributaries by way of review. This again from For the Record program 350. What we're going to be doing as the first item up, so to speak, in this side is excerpting a section of RFA program number 8 that is about the assassination of Martin Luther King. As we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, including The Guns of November Part 4 and RFA number 8, among others, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting the assassinations of both John Kennedy in November of 1963 with that of his brother Robert in June of 1968, and in turn connecting those assassinations to the assassination of Martin Luther King 2 months before Robert Kennedy was killed, and in turn those assassinations have strong evidentiary tributaries running to the shooting of George Wallace in May of 1972. Now, it is my belief, and this is conjectural, that Sheikh Rahman was alluding to the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was a Palestinian Arab named Saran Saran. As we looked at in RFA program number 9, dealing with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the evidence suggesting that Saran was not the assassin but was the carefully manipulated patsy is very, very strong indeed. Saran, however, was a Palestinian Arab who ostensibly wanted to kill Robert Kennedy because of his support for Israel. The evidence suggests very strongly that, in fact, it was the same type of elements, in fact, the same elements who killed Robert Kennedy, the elements who killed Robert Kennedy were the same as those who had killed his brother and Martin Luther King. We concluded side one by examining a section of the book Government by Gunplay, co-authored or co-edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Azizian. In turn, we looked at an essay about the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, now associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In turn, that essay dealt with, among other things, an affidavit submitted by Robert Byron Watson, who was working at the Magellan Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia. As we're going to look at in this excerpt of RFA program number 8, Robert Byron Watson had come across apparent elements of the assassination plot against Martin Luther King and against Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was killed 2 months after Martin Luther King. And these assassinations, in turn, as we've looked at in other broadcasts, link up with the assassination of John Kennedy. Among the elements that you're going to hear described here are former U.S. Representative Larry McDonald of Georgia. Larry McDonald was in turn associated with Western Goals, an ultra-right-wing private intelligence organization that, among other things, was utilizing elements of the Los Angeles Police Department's Public Disorder and Intelligence Division to spy on people in Los Angeles. That case was the focal point of a civil suit, and before Larry McDonald could give evidence in that case, he was killed Korean Airlines Flight 007 was brought down. That was a major incident in the Cold War, and the evidence would suggest that it was not, in fact, the Soviets who brought that down, but that was the official version in what appears to have been either a provocation and or some other type of manipulated incident. We haven't got time to go into that now, but note the following excerpt from RFA 8, this is about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Do note that Larry McDonald was connected with this milieu. Note, in particular, the name of Fuad Habash. Fuad Habash's name was apparently part of Fuad Habash, I should say, the brother of George Habash, about whom we're going to say more in a few minutes. Fuad Habash was connected to the group that appears, from the information we're about to hear, to have been connected to killing not only Martin Luther King, but also Robert Kennedy. Bear in mind that the patsy for the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Saran Saran, was a Palestinian Arab. It is my belief that Rahman was alluding to Saran Saran in the belief that it was actually Saran who committed the assassination. But note the name of Fuad Habash and the name of Anthony Malek, and note the connection of Fuad Habash to his brother George. This is from RFA number 8, recorded on April 4th, 1985, in addition to my own voice. You will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Now, this article is entitled, this again, from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, July of 1977, Volume 1, Number 1. The article is entitled, King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed. This is by a man named David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E. And Wemple writes, through nearly a decade of threats, blackmail, beatings, and murder attempts, Robert Byron Watson has steadfastly maintained that both the United States federal government and the forces of organized crime have persecuted, framed, and imprisoned him for one reason and one reason only, that he possesses knowledge implicating agents of these groups in a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. For those willing to hear his story, it should become readily apparent why the endless mysteries of America's political assassinations remain unsolved. When the intimacy existing between government, organized crime, and the intelligence community is laid out before one's eyes, it must seriously be questioned whether or not our present form of government can weather the intense scrutiny to which such knowledge must lead us. Watson was but a young man when on March 28, 1968, he claims to have overheard a portion of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. As an acknowledged authority on art history and archaeology, even by those whom he most closely identifies with the conspiracy, he became employed at Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked at the pricing of various artifacts. Magellan, by the way, is M-A-G-E-L-L-O-N. The gallery's business associates were fighting amongst themselves, however, by Christmas of 1967. It wasn't until a year or so later that Watson learned of the reason for this split. Bill Arnett, A-R-N-E-T-T, one of the original gallery partners, had apparently begun to suspect several others of using the gallery to front for illegal operations involving what Byron Watson consistently refers to in statements as, quote, the syndicate, unquote. The type of individual who often found his way to the halls of Magellan's, according to Watson, was characterized by a rather frequent visitor named Larry McDonald. A United States representative from Georgia, McDonald reigns from Marietta, from which the awesome and scandal-ridden Lockheed Corporation bases its East Coast operations. Aside from his membership on the John Birch Society's National Council, McDonald has been accused by the U.S. Labor Party and others of acting as a conduit for intelligence operations and various ultra-right-wing groups. In the meantime, he has gained a notoriety of sorts by saturating the congressional record with tirades like Maoist subversives in U.S. factories and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship with the communists. Within such an atmosphere of reactionary politics and corruption, says Watson, syndicate operations flourished, which included gold bullion smuggling from South America, as well as the importation upon a truly vast scale of cocaine and heroin.
Okay, skipping along in the article. The operations into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any, quote, evidence of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. I should just mention that Bill Jackson, mentioned here in the article, is one of the people, I believe, that was mentioned as, along with Gene Purcell and Bill Jackson's brother, Herman Jackson, as being the people that were having a discussion with Jerry Adams about these people all, of course, being Byron Watson's employers, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to get back to Herman Jackson a little later on, but remember that Herman Jackson is one of the people involved in this, and this is his brother Bill Jackson that Watson is claiming was involved with buying these teak logs. Okay. These teak logs were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald Eves. Eves, whose, quote, conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, had proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with.
As fate would have it, Watson's hurried journey to Chile would provide a vital piece to the puzzle of the King assassination. It was while in Santiago that Byron found it literally impossible to receive any funds which had been sent to him from home. When there was some more money to be had, he was befriended by the South American director of the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fuad Habash Ansara, whose brother George Habash is the leader of the National Front. Habash and Watson, as it turned out, had a mutual acquaintance who often visited Magellan's in Atlanta. That man, Dr. Anthony N. Malik, was the party named by Watson as buying the gold bullion which was being smuggled into the United States by Herman Jackson. Recall that Herman Jackson is the alias which apparently Jack Youngblood used, or someone who used a number of different names, including Jack Youngblood. Habash and others apparently suspected Malik of being a double agent with the CIA, a possibility which surfaced when Malik traveled to Chile immediately prior to the CIA-inspired coup d'etat against Allende in 1973. If Habash's suspicions were correct, Malik was one of those CIA agents who had attempted to infiltrate such national liberation organizations as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Central Intelligence Agency has, in fact, carried out infiltrative and provocative acts against such American groups as the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, and Students for a Democratic Society. Later in 1974, Watson claims that Herman Jackson told him that Malik was also, quote, the man who conceived most of the plan and worked out most of the details which were employed to assassinate Senator Robert Kennedy.
Now, again, note the name of Fuad Habash, who was part of that milieu, apparently involved, at least according to Robert Byron Watson, whose investigations or whose allegations were to a considerable extent, as we looked at in Side 1, supported by subsequent investigations, of the name of Fuad Habash, the brother of George Habash, should be noted in that regard. Note also that one of the associates of Fuad Habash was Anthony Malik, according to Robert Byron Watson, one of the key players in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, the patsy in that assassination, Saran Saran, was a Palestinian Arab who supposedly killed Robert Kennedy because of his antipathy to Kennedy's support for Israel. That again, excerpted from For the Record program number 350, and in turn, you heard an excerpt from RFA number 8. Now, jumping from the milieu of François Janoux and the PFLP, and it's not much of a jump at all, bear in mind that Janoux protégé and lawyer for Klaus Barbie, Jacques Vergès, has one of his protégés and fellow attorneys in his law firm, Isabelle Couton-Père, representing the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In this past week, as I speak, on May 19th of 2002, the disclosures about Zacharias Moussaoui and the 20th hijacker have been in the news. The New York Times of Wednesday, May 15th of 2002, Washington, May 14th, article by David Johnston, headlined, Pre-attack memo cited bin Laden, subtitled, New details of FBI agents warning on flight schools. And by the way, in For the Record program 349, I supplemented my speculation that the FBI has actually been subverted from within as part of an operational plan to subvert and destroy the United States with ideological prongs from both the right and the left from within the country. This is like the attack on France in World War II. It is an attack from without at the same time as it is being coupled by a subversive effort from within, that coming from both the right and the left. Now, of Zacharias Moussaoui and these warnings alluded to in the article of May 15th of 2002 from the New York Times, skipping down. The memorandum may not be the only internal document embarrassing to the Bureau. In August, an agent speculated in notes made when investigators sought to explain why Zacharias Moussaoui was enrolled in a Minnesota flight school that Mr. Moussaoui might be planning to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. Mr. Massawi, a French citizen, was soon arrested on immigration charges believed by the United States government to be the intended 20th hijacker on September 11th. Now, more about forewarnings of this plan. The New York Times of Saturday, May 18th of 2002, has the following article by Philip Sheenan, Dateline Washington, May 17th, headlined, FBI knew for years about terror pilot training. And this alludes to a disclosure that came from the Philippines, skipping down. However, alluding to the memorandum that we heard about earlier, however, the Phoenix memorandum was not the first warning that terrorists affiliated with al-Qaeda had interest in learning to fly. In his 1996 confession, a Pakistani terrorist, Abdul Hakim Murad, said that he planned to use the training he received at flight schools in the United States to fly a plane into CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, or another federal building. Mr. Murad, who was captured in the Philippines in 1995 and convicted in New York on charges of conspiring to blow up 12 American jumbo jets over the Pacific simultaneously, received flight training at schools in New York, North Carolina, California, and Texas. Information from Mr. Murad's confession formed a basis for an analysis prepared for United States intelligence agencies in 1999. The analysis warned that bin Laden terrorists could hijack a jet and fly it into government buildings like the Pentagon. Now remember Hakim Murad, we're going to review an element of Operation Bojinka, Serbo-Croatian for Big Bang. This from the book Al-Qaeda, subtitled Brotherhood of Terror by Paul L. Williams. This book was published in softcover by Alpha, a division of Pearson Education. Copyright 2002, ISBN 0-02-864352-6. Of Hakim Murad, Operation Bojinka, links between Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center attack, and the attack on the Oklahoma City building, the blowing up of the Oklahoma City building. While making final preparations for Bojinka, the terrorists met with Terry L. Nichols several times in Cebu City, the Philippines. Nichols, along with Timothy McVeigh, were charged with the bombing of the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City on April 19, 1995, that killed 168 people and wounded another 600. Some FBI officials now believe that Nichols, who has a mail-order Filipino wife from Cebu, obtained contact with Youssef through Muslim students at Southwest College in Weatherford, Oklahoma. The officials further believe that Youssef and Murad provided Nichols with training in making and handling bombs. Without such instruction, Nichols and McVeigh would not have been able to assemble a 5,600-pound bomb made of ammonium nitrate and nitromethane. Several informants recently gave testimony that they met Nichols with Youssef in the Philippines and that the American was affectionately known there as the farmer, unquote. Bear in mind that Timothy McVeigh was witnessed in combination with Middle Eastern men. His attorney was, or his protege, he was the protege in turn of Andreas Strassmeyer, the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, the architect of German reunification and a charter member of the Nazi Party. Andreas Strassmeyer's attorney was Aryan Nations attorney Kirk Lyons. So connect the dots, those are the ties that bind. Note that there are now warnings of a new attack, possibly nuclear. Various programs that I've done are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, email, mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit their Real Audio Equipped website at www.spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section, there are detailed annotated descriptions of all of the programs I've done about September 11th. Those are the book that I'm writing and have published, so you check it out. There are also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, with all of the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming, others available for download only. And in response to those who have asked, well, when are you going to write a book? When are you going to publish? That is on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. I have. It's there. If you want it, print it and read it. Get with the program, so to speak, or else you will pay the price. That concludes For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, Part 4, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.